topic for our skip events today is one that's very, very pertinent. It's looking at supply chain transformation, but from a slightly different perspective. We quite often talk about supply chains being demand driven or customer driven, or in the case of my own research, even customer responsive. But increasingly, we've perhaps thought about things as being supply chains being customer centric. In our webinar today, we're actually going to challenge that view of customer centricity to actually think about this in a different way and to actually think about what it might mean to think about the customer actually being inside the supply chain. So, as you know, our supply chains in practice webinars are a little bit more informal than some of the webinars you may attend. We actually do try to encourage participation and we like to hear your voices. Just to let you know that this session will be recorded and we do want you to be interactive. However, during the actual presentations, it would be great if you could be interactive by actually posting your questions, thoughts and comments in the chat function, which you should all be able to make live by clicking on the speech bubble at the top of your screens. We will then, after the presentations, move to a panel discussion. At that point, we'll try to address the questions actually in the chat. But equally, if you'd like to put your hands up, then you'll have the opportunity to actually ask your questions live, because we think that's really, really important within our Supply Chains in Practice network. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our two speakers of today, because the session really is going to look at this topic from two perspectives. So Martin Christopher, who's an Emeritus Professor of Marketing and Logistics at Cranfield University, but is also a visiting professor at WMG, will begin the session. And he'll be presenting some of the views that look at this from a slightly more technical background, before Powan will then go on to build upon that in terms of what it actually means to put the transformation into practice. We will be making available to you after the webinar a paper that Martin has written in conjunction with E2Open that actually looks at this topic in more depth, and that will be available on our capstone pages following the webinar. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Martin, who's going to look at how we move from supply chains to the ecosystem concept, which actually provides that platform from putting the customer in the center to the customer inside. So thank you very much, Martin.
Thank you, Jan. And I'm pleased to have this opportunity to share these ideas with you. It's interesting how, you know, terminology sort of changes. It's not that long since we've been using the phrase supply chains. It's, I guess, just about 30 years ago since the phrase was first coined. And I guess, you know, the idea of a supply chain makes a lot of sense. It's about how we move stuff from, you know, one node to another through different links and so on. But I think, as we've all come to recognize, the idea of the chain may be slightly an oversimplification. I think particularly in the context of today's marketplace, because the big change that's taken place really over the last, I don't know, 50 or so years has been the move from a seller's market to a buyer's market. It's very much the case today that the customer's in the driving seat. And that wasn't always the case, as we know. And indeed, I guess the idea of a supply chain originally was that it began in the factory and it eventually ended up delivering a product preordained, predetermined to the customer, where the customer had very little choice and very little say in the whole process. I guess that's really, you know, the supply chain of the past. Now we've come to recognize that we've got to turn things around, and lots of people have talked about, as Jan was saying, customer centricity and talking about putting the customer at the start of the supply chain rather than the end of the supply chain. But I think we've got to go beyond that. And this is really the focus of what I'd like to talk about. It might be interesting just to remind folks of my own particular background, which is as professor of marketing and logistics. And I've always really focused around that sort of interface between marketing strategy and how we go to market and how we serve the customer. And, you know, the supply chain and everything else really is subsidiary to all of that. It's about how we actually deliver that that experience. And in fact, I think this sort of growing realization amongst many businesses today that customers never really bought products anyway. They were buying outcomes. They were looking for an experience. They're looking for the service impact, and the product itself is sort of just the vehicle by which we deliver that. So I think what we're really seeing here is a sort of a move towards a different perspective of how we look at. I'm going to use the phrase supply chain. There's no point in trying to sort of change the language that we've been using for so long. But I just want to make this point, though, that they have evolved from a linear factory outwards idea to this network concept. And the view, I think, increasingly that we need to operationalize is how, in fact, do you put the customer inside this network? Some people are talking about an ecosystem, and I quite like that analogy. It's the sort of notion that we have many different agencies and players who the overall creation of value. The dependencies are great. It's, I guess, using ideas from ecology and so forth about how everything basically is connected. And so we, instead of thinking this as a sort of sequence of events, as we gather materials, as we put them through a production transformation, as we deliver to a customer, but rather to think of that customer as actually wanting to specify the outcomes they're looking for, the experiences that they want, and indeed even being able to determine the sources from which those different elements of that package are going to be drawn, and they become the specifier. And the role of all those different elements and agencies and players is really to sort of find a way in which they can work together to co-create that value. And this idea of co-creation is quite an interesting sort of notion. In the past, I guess, you know, I suppose in a production-oriented view of things, the supplying company was the determinant of what that value was going to be and the form it was going to take. Very much a production-oriented sort of view of things. And that's, I guess, how many of our sort of businesses were structured, and the supply chains that we created were based on that principle. This idea of co-creation is one that's been taking, I guess, a lot of airtime in if you talk to our marketing colleagues these days. Yeah, we've always talked about the need to, you know, get the customer on side and get the customer's viewpoint, market research and all of these sorts of things has long been seeking to capture ideas from the marketplace and try to translate these into products. But this goes beyond that. The idea of co-curation, and these two academics from the States, Prahalad and Ramaswamy, one of the sort of two, I should say, of the early developers of this idea, their definition is pretty simple. They talk about co-creation as being the joint creation of value by the company and the customer, allowing the customer to co-construct the service experience. So it's very much more than actually, you know, specifying what they want. They're also specifying how they want to get it, even to the extent of actually saying, I want this particular element to be delivered by this particular provider, some other element to come from somewhere else. The whole thing being delivered. at a time and place of that customer's choosing. And the real question, I guess, is, are our supply chains capable of doing this? Have they got the sort of flexibility that's obviously going to be required if this idea of co-creation is to become a reality? And I think also, too, just to add to the complexity of all of this, we have to recognize that no two customers are alike in what they actually seek. Marketing people have long talked about the need for market segmentation, you know, where we group customers into sort of similar cohorts and seek to differentiate the offer by segment. But this is taking it just way beyond that, because it's effectively talking about segments of one. And it's really talking about how we can design a supply chain that's flexible enough to be able to deliver different packages in different ways at different times. This is quite a distance from the sort of traditional notion of what a supply chain actually should look like. I think maybe it would be good to use an example here. And there's a fairly successful business in the States called Instacart. Only been going about 10 years, but pretty successful. The idea of Instacart basically is that it works with something like 500 plus retailers across North America, including players like Walmart and 7-Eleven. And the idea is that they can access all of the stores owned by those 500 plus partners, something like 40,000 stores across North America, carrying something like well over 1,000 brands. And they're enabling customers across North America online to buy from that vast range of options. The ecosystem includes something like over 100,000 individuals. They call them shoppers. These are people a little bit like a sort of Uber driver. They're people who work for themselves. They work for as little or as much as they want to. They actually do the shopping on behalf of those consumers. They make the deliveries to the location specified by that consumer. The whole system is backed up by some pretty smart software using artificial intelligence, which enables substitutions to be made. They can also, of course, use all that data that they're capturing to work with those retail partners to better identify trends, to make better decisions about assortment of products in the stores, also to better manage availability, because obviously they're able to identify stockouts in real time. And it's a real sort of ecosystem sort of concept. All of these different entities and players who come together through this particular platform, the platform provided by Instacart. And there are a growing number of examples of other companies like this, who are providing the means by which the different sort of capabilities across that ecosystem can be drawn upon and can be sort of focused around that customer that's in the inside, if you like, of that ecosystem. I think that's a very interesting sort of example. And in a way, to me, it sort of suggests the way in which we're going to be, I think, increasingly moving in the future, where we see this sort of constellation of different providers being brought together and orchestrated, if you like, through a platform and focused around providing the value that's specified by that customer. Again, marketing people have long talked about value propositions, and typically these have tended to be sort of fairly sort of broad-based, and they focus around the organization itself. I mean, if we take an example, you know, Walmart, since we're talking retail, Walmart's value proposition in the early days and still today is very much the same. It's everyday low price, a very simple concept, but it basically spells out the compelling reason why anybody should want to come and do business with me. That's the value proposition. Well, now what we're really saying is, well, it's no good having a sort of generic value proposition. We've got to personalize this value proposition. And that leads us to almost what we could call a personal supply chain, because in the same way that, as we said before, every customer is different, to meet those different requirements will need us to sort of draw upon a whole number of different combinations of supply possibilities. And so this is really, I think, a whole different notion of what a supply network or ecosystem is going to look like. And I guess the really interesting question is, well, how do we actually sort of make this work in practice? Because essentially what we're talking about here is managing multiple pipelines through this network, sharing in inventory. Obviously, if we take the sort of ideas of omni channel retail, for instance, this is a well-accepted principle that rather than have every channel managing its own inventories, where we can, we share inventory, we share facilities within that organization. But this is taking it a step further. It's saying, well, why don't we share it right across the network, even where necessary with competitors, not just sharing inventory, but sharing assets. Again, I think we're starting to see many signs of this sort of trend happening in the wider world. Some call this the sharing economy, you know, where the idea is we don't need to own a car. We can just, you know, access one when we need it. Some might call this the Uberization of the way we do things. And this trend is certainly there. It's very apparent and it's growing. But we can see, I think, similar trends in B2B. I mean, most of these examples we've been talking about are drawn from B2C. But the notion that we shouldn't necessarily own all the assets in our network, but we use other people's, it's all part of that sort of ecosystem concept. And obviously, the whole thing being driven by data captured in as close to real time as possible, using advanced analytics, obviously, like the Instacart example, to identify what's really going on in the real marketplace. You know, we've talked about being demand-driven for years. Well, this is the real opportunity to become demand-driven in the sense that we're now much better able to sense and respond to demand as it happens. Now, just a few years ago, this would have been dismissed as science fiction or the sort of ravings of some demented academic. But it's actually happening around us now. Another interesting case example is the German e-commerce retailer Otto, where they're using AI and advanced analytics, deep learning and so forth, to get forecasts of customer demand which are 90% accurate. I mean, that's a level of accuracy that's never been seen in the past with traditional statistical forecasting methods. So I think we shouldn't dismiss this as something which is a sort of fantasy. It's actually happening now, and it's going to happen increasingly as we move forward. There are a number of things that are sort of stopping progress, of course, and I think many of them are not technical. Many of them are to do with mindsets and the way that we think and the way we organize in the business. I mean, are we prepared to move much further down the road of collaboration, for instance, seeking out opportunities to collaborate horizontally as well as vertically? Vertically, of course, is the notion of a classic supply chain, collaborating upstream with our suppliers and downstream with our distributors. Whereas horizontal collaboration is where we reach out even to competitors, and say, look, you know, maybe it makes sense if we actually share a certain of our assets. We'll still compete, but we could actually both benefit from this way. And we're starting to see a lot of this way of thinking now in a whole number of different industries, sharing production capability, using third parties sometimes, using contract manufacturers and so on. Some commentators have described this as the idea of cooperating to grow the cake or the pie and then competing on how to slice it. Because the idea is if the cake is bigger, even though you may still get the same percentage share, it's a bigger piece. And so this is really the thinking behind this. And recognizing that in this complex world, we don't have a monopoly on ideas and knowledge and capabilities. We've got to use other people's knowledge and capabilities. And we can only access that through a much higher level of collaborative working. So this, I think, is a fundamental prerequisite for moving forward in this direction. And I guess just to tie this to together and bring it to a little bit of a conclusion, I think it's pretty apparent, isn't it, that if we are in this moving towards this sort of notion of an ecosystem, where all these different entities need to be connected and integrated and synchronized, then the need for orchestration, you know, is pretty apparent. And I would argue that this is, in fact, the new role for supply chain management in the 21st century. Is to be an orchestrator, is to be right there in the center, so to speak, seeking to be a key player in how we actually do co-create value in this marketplace that we've described. Well, hopefully there's been a few thoughts and ideas there which might have sparked some ideas with yourselves, and I certainly look forward to discussing this further at the end of this webinar. But before we get to that point, I'm going to hand over to my colleague from E2Open, Pawan Jossi, who's Executive Vice President for Products and Strategy, to take this idea further forward. Over to you, Pawan.
Thank you, Mark. Let's see if I can move forward. Martin touched upon a very important concept around, orchestrating the supply chain, right? Really becoming the conductor and being able to run the symphony, you know, of all the players that are in the supply chain that bring products or service or experience or value to market. Being in this space for the last 25 odd years, you know, both on the academic side, on research, as well as on the practice side for the last 20 years or so, you know, I personally and we at E2Open have looked at this problem, you know, along multiple dimensions. And what we've really seen is the concept of orchestration is becoming more and more important. And so far, we keep thinking about orchestration from the standpoint of a brand owner or the manufacturing facility or the manufacturer, the person, the entity that is bringing products to market. And I think the slight pivot as we start thinking about this particular topic is, can we bring the customer, the consumer, the person that seeks the end result, the value proposition, the experience, become closer and closer to actually being the conductor of that symphony, right? If you keep that at the back of your mind as we go through this presentation, you know, that's the concept that we're trying to tease out to say, how do we actually bring the consumer who's so far removed from that experience to really be the conductor of this orchestra that we call a supply chain? Right. So as we start thinking about those, you know, the transformation, I would argue, has already started, and we're seeing some of the underpinnings of that across multiple industries. And I'll take a couple of examples. Right. The way we consume, you know, soft drinks, soda, pop, whatever we call it, in whichever part of the world is changing. And Coca-Cola, as an example, has been at the forefront of some of this stuff. You know, we're not buying, you know, packaged, prepackaged in flavor and size from shelves. We have the ability to actually walk up to a machine and create our own flavor with the size that we want and be able to consume that, you know, as and when we want it. the same thing applies to a very different industry. If you look at the transformation, and Martin touched upon this, from a mobility standpoint, is the ownership of a car, the automotive ownership. That also is transforming. You know, Uber has transformed it along one dimension, but we're also seeing the fact that if somebody actually wants to own a car, can a subscription model work? And there are various companies that are actually toying with this idea. And the subscription essentially is a concept of not only being able to have a car, but have a car and pay a monthly fee for it. And that fee takes care of everything that is associated with the car, whether it's maintenance, whether it's insurance, whether it's parking, whether it is, you know, how the car gets delivered, and also have the option of switching some of those cars out. Some of those programs have that. So if I have a program, but let's say a Jaguar Land Rover, I have the ability to walk in and buy an F-type and then change it over to a different vehicle when I want to over a certain period of time. Now, the companies are toying with that idea. You see some of these companies ramping up, others are winding down based on their experiences. But what that has really created is a new role for, you know, the concept of the auto dealerships. So Martin touched upon the concept of horizontal collaboration. These auto dealerships are bringing that concept of subscription, automotive subscription, in a horizontal collaboration manner. So I could walk up and sign up for any one of these programs. And by the way, I picked up this as an example of one of my local dealerships here in Dallas, US. This is what they offer. And the beauty of this program is really, if I sign up for any one of these programs, I now have the ability to not only go to one of my brands and get that car, but I have the ability to go across brands and get that experience as and when I want it. And this dealership has taken it to the next level where they have promise a 2-hour SLA. I could actually on an app pick the car that I want and I say, please bring it to my house and take my existing car away and drop off this new one. I could actually tailor that experience depending on what I wanted to do. You know, during the weekend, in the morning, I want to take my family out along with my dog. So I want a bigger car, an SUV. In the evening, I want to go out, for dinner with my wife. I want more of a sports car or a stylish car or a convertible, depending on the season. And I could actually make that experience happen. So all of a sudden now, the concept of, owning a car is completely transformed to owning the car that you want, depending on that time of the day. Right. And this is, again, an example of whether we don't know whether it's going to be successful or not, but the transition is happening there. Now, if you take a step back and think about how these are actually happening and why these are actually happening, the reality is the concept of being able to bring a personalized experience right to the end consumer has never been more promising. And I would argue, and a lot of people would probably agree, that the concept of connectedness, both in terms of people and in terms of data and in terms of this whole world, has a very important role to play. And internet has been probably the single most important factor that has brought it all together. Now, what the internet has really done is brought three things together, which is the access to knowledge. Not only can I know what I want, how do I explore all the cars that are available? How do I know what kind of flavors do I like, right? The access to knowledge, the ability to apply that knowledge and understand what is needed, and the opportunity to collaborate and co-create is extremely important, and it's been facilitating that. But I would argue that all those three concepts are actually happening simultaneously at an extremely global scale, but also being very hyper-local in terms of their execution. So think about the Instacart example. That's a hyper-local experience that has been brought in where I actually decide which stores I want to get what product to be delivered to my home using somebody that's extremely local to me, right? And then I take a step back and say, the product that I'm actually buying was actually sourced in Sumatra because that is the coffee bean that I'm really interested in. How did that actually happen? The reason why that happened was because Walmart was able to source it, or Target was able to source it, or Kroger was able to source it from the right place at the right time and bring it to the shelf. And then I utilized a very hyper-local medium of delivery exactly to my home without even getting out of my couch, right? That's the concept that all of a sudden you realize that the information on the need, which was in the heads of the consumer, and the information on how those needs could be solved, which was in the heads of the provider, all of a sudden now can be smashed together to create that desired product or service or that experience. And we're smashing them together into packets that are easily digestible, but this still needs a supply chain in the back, and it still needs the customer experience and the customer needs in the front, right? Now, As we look at the traditional supply chain, and we've thought about this from a provider standpoint, think about the providers as really the brand owners, that transformation is well underway, and it's been underway for decades now, right? We look at that traditional way of vertically integrated, you know, iron ore on one side and, you know, cars coming on the other side, and you can buy any car you want as long as it's in black and you pick it out of my factory, come to pick it out of my factory, right? Those days are gone, never ever gonna happen. And what they're really transforming into is the supply chains of the future, which are really utilizing the global footprint of, you know, sourcing of commodities, of raw materials, of manufacturing, of special skills, and bringing products to market. And that transition is already happening. I mean, we look at an example of Dell in this particular case, completely transforming its supply chain and continuing to do that. But this is not there for Dell. I mean, you look at the Boeing 787 that has been produced exactly the same manner. You look at Procter & Gamble. You look at a whole range of industries that are transforming this way. But the challenge is, as we start putting into this context, the next set of examples, think about Coca-Cola trying to run a supply chain of not only packaging products and putting them on shelf, but also being able to support the raw materials and ingredients needed to create hundreds of flavors out of that freestyle machine. Think about what a dealership would look like if they have to source cars from all over the world and be able to present that subscription experience across the board. Think about what Instacart would have to do if they actually were managing the entire supply chain at the back of it. That transformation is critical. And that transformation, as we put the customers in the center and start thinking about it from a brand owner standpoint as a supply chain of one, makes this problem extremely complex. You're not only just saying, I want to bring cars to market, I want to bring a special experience or a special flavor to market. And that creates a huge amount of problems for, you know, the brand owners. Now, that problem for the brand owners is not getting simple. It's getting more and more complex as you add more and more, you know, vertical slices of the products that they bring to market. This is an example of the current footprint that our brand owners, our large manufacturers, you know, have to deal with on a daily basis. Really, the systems, the technology, the infrastructure, the data, the decision-making process is highly siloed. And it's siloed for all good reasons as it has evolved to this point. We had to create this infrastructure to be able to scale the way we had to scale to meet the mass production needs, to meet the, you know, the needs of being able to customize, being able to, you know, break the manufacturing process into chunks and make it highly repeatable so that you could actually support a mass production type environment and bring, you know, products to market at the right price point. But this is exactly what is preventing us from pivoting over to the next big evolution, which is how do I now take the customer and put them right in the middle? How do I actually create differentiated offerings in the market where I'm actually, you know, being held back by these kind of infrastructures? And these infrastructures are not just a function of one entity. Think about the thousands of entities that are involved in a supply chain process. You know, your manufacturers, your tier one suppliers, your distributors, your 3PL logistics service providers, your retailers all have to deal with this. Now, our thought process and our experience as we've done this for the last 20 years at E2Open is really there are four fundamental things that we have to think through to think about transforming ourselves to get closer and closer to meet the needs of that supply chain of one, to think about a horizontal collaboration, to think about moving away from that orchestrator of the companies or the brand owners ecosystem to really making the customer, the consumer, the orchestrator of that particular experience that they want. And our hypothesis is that you really need four key building blocks to really start thinking about this from a differentiated standpoint, from a digital standpoint, if you want to call one of the buzzwords to, you know, summarize it all. Our philosophy is that first and foremost, you need a network. You need a network because when you start thinking about an experience, you have to think about who all are involved in that experience and who all will come and go to provide that experience. That network is extremely critical. How do you actually very quickly assimilate and bring together a collection of entities in the context of a product, in the context of an experience, and be able to provide that or bring that to market? The second is the data that is flowing through. Being able to understand and normalize and harmonize across a uniform nomenclature, and that uniform is not that, you know, a universal language. It is the ability to say, I want X, and you understanding that when I say I want X, you really, you know that it actually means Y when it comes to your system, right? I want a pack of Coke. You understand that pack of Coke, when I say is a six pack, and somebody else, when it is producing it, is, you know, 20 gallons of syrup and, you know, a carbonated cylinder on one side. The third is the applications. Applications are important. And then the reason why they're important is because once you're able to bring the networks and data together, and Martin touched upon this, you have to be able to process that need and be able to understand how would you actually satisfy that need. And the concept of Instacart, that those applications are really somebody placing an order saying, I want, you know, 20 products from this particular store and 40 products from the other store. Instacart being able to figure out how do I actually get that one person to pick it up from both those stores and deliver to me at the right point and in the right location. Those are all examples of application. If you think about it from a traditional manufacturing standpoint, those applications tend to be demand sensing and inventory optimization, things like that. And then the last piece, which is extremely important, is collaboration. We cannot put the customer in the middle of this whole experience, or even a brand owner in the middle of this whole experience, if you cannot have everybody singing off the same song sheet. If you're not able to pass the same, same symphony song sheet to everybody and then have the conductor play that. And that's where collaboration comes in. Being able to say, can the keyboard play this note? Can the violins and the strings do this? Can the percussions play this thing? And if they cannot, how do I actually, you know, on the fly, be able to adjust without having to go off band? And that's really where collaboration comes in, is becoming more and more important to deal with the realities of the world, not just in terms of what will happen and what can be done, but more importantly, what happens when a disruption takes place or an opportunity arises. So as we think about that, at E2Open, we have looked at and thought about this. The only way to solve this problem is to start looking at it from an end-to-end perspective, start looking at it not just from a consumer on one side and supplier on the other side and manufacturing in the middle, but how do you actually bring it all together so that those decisions can be made in unison as a brand owner to begin with, where the brand owner becomes the orchestrator first, and then the brand owner starts giving the song sheets or giving the conductor role to the consumers, you know, as they move along. So that's the natural evolution that we see there. For us, as we start thinking about this architecture, the most important piece, as I touched upon, is the network. The network, think about these as the ecosystems, and Martin touched upon the concept of ecosystems. The ecosystems that are helping the customer or the brand owner bring manufacture products, think about that as your supply ecosystem. Think about the way the product actually gets delivered to me as an end consumer. Think about that as my demand ecosystem. Think about the logistics of how where the products are made to where they're actually being delivered as my logistics ecosystem that is bringing that. And then finally, I have to, and in most cases, leverage, you know, the concept of sourcing across the globe, the concept of utilizing core competencies across the globe, and really being able to deal with what is possible and what is not. You know, I want to be able to source, you know, my particular coffee bean from a certain part of the world that is guaranteed to be, you know, ethically sound and ethically sourced. How do I make sure that that is even possible? How do I actually make sure I leverage, you know, some of the trade rules and regulations across the world? So our hypothesis really here is, not only do you need an architecture or framework, but the most important part is you need a network, and that network has to constantly grow. So to kind of wrap this back up, you know, as we start thinking about putting customer in the middle, or as think about an orchestrator model, or think about the role of an orchestration process, the only sustainable way to do this is to start thinking about the planning, execution, and the network all together. Is to be able to think about this not as, okay, product will get delivered to me or I'll go to a store to buy it, but really to be able to say, how do I actually get the product to where it needs to be, both in terms of planning for it, in terms of executing for it, and most importantly, bringing the entire network and the entire set of ecosystems that are responsible for making that happen, all operating in unison. And whether you put the brand owner or the manufacturer as the orchestrator to begin with, and then slowly hand over the reins to the consumer as and when you get to that point, the core most important part is that. And we believe that the key enablers for that are there from a technology standpoint, access to data, the ability to run, you know, applications, the ability to collaborate, the ability to throw more and more automation and more optimization, more and more artificial intelligence and learning into this, all exists. But to summarize and bring it right back in, I want to end up with what and reiterate what Martin said. The difficult part oftentimes is not the technology. The difficult part really here is, how do you change the mindset? How do you actually agree to transform and agree that it's going to be a collaborative exercise, and that collaborative exercise is not just between me and my partners today, but me and my competitors today that might become, you know, co-creators or co-innovators alongside me. So the concept of collaboration, both horizontal and vertical, is really critical for us to transform this. And you got to transform not just from within, you got to transform, you know, outside and alongside others. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Jen, over to you.
Callum, thank you very, very much. And my thanks to Martin as well. Mark Haslam is obviously, I don't know if you've seen it, Martin, he's a fan and he's inspired by you as ever, as we all are. So thanks for the comment, Mark. But I'm going to start by, I see there's a question from John Burdett. I don't know if you want to ask your question live, John. Maybe not. So John works for Tata Consumer Products, and his question to you, Martin, was that what are the classical approaches for collaborations between companies as a joint venture? So I suppose what you've been talking about is this shift. If you think about it, it's about network-based competition, and network-based competition has various different contractual models. And one of those contractual models is the joint venture. So John's perhaps identifying that joint ventures typically have a shelf life, maybe around 10 years. So he's wanting to know, do you see other forms of network-based competition that are going to be required or collaboration structures to support this type of approach?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, joint ventures obviously have a role to play, and we'll always do so, but they tend to be a little bit more formal and live for a certain length of time, obviously. I think I rather see this more as a sort of idea that I like to use the analogy of the director of a theatre company, where he's maybe putting on a sort of season of plays, maybe not at the moment during lockdown, but in normal times. And he's got a troupe of actors, basically, and he's drawn those from a portfolio of actors with whom he's had relationships, he's worked with them in the past, or she has, and they know each other's strengths and weaknesses, and they come together for that particular project, basically. And between them, they're creating that value proposition, so to speak. But next year, it's going to be completely different. He's going to draw again. Maybe some of the players will be the same, but others will be different. And I think it's this idea of building a network of relationships and investing in relationships, which gives us that sort of level of fluidity. It's much more fluid because clearly every customer has a requirement at this point in time, and those needs change. And so the partners who will be players in this ecosystem will be in a constant state of flux. So yeah, it's a very interesting question that's been raised here, because we're so used to sort of having sort of longer lasting, legally based partnership arrangements and so on, whereas we're now talking about fairly high intensive relationships, but maybe for a relatively short duration.
Thanks, Martin. I think it's quite interesting, because it's, for me, it's about I can see all the advantages, and it is highly attractive. The idea that you can sort of move flexibly around, be quite agile in terms of your relationships. I think that to take it beyond the JV, maybe that was a bit too, as you're right, it's a very formal structure, but it's still the underpinning question is how is it coordinated and orchestrated, and who is doing the orchestration? And particularly though, if you think about the partners or the interest within that supply chain, managing those interests and the sharing of value is going to be one of the critical things to achieve. And that's, I think, the big question, well, for me, is one of the big questions that we need to unlock. Now the technology is there to enable these new processes to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I might just comment to that point. So we were involved in a project called UK Sites, which was looking at how you would basically develop new business models around connected vehicles. And a lot of the research is done around getting the technology to work. And this was a project that had all sorts in it, from telecoms providers to onboard technology providers to automotive suppliers, infrastructure, you know, you name it, they're involved. The issue wasn't the technology. The issue was trying to work out how you developed a business model. And in essence, it needed to be a cooperative business model, because at the end of the day, these people needed to collaborate to compete. And in a way, we needed not a use case that was a technology-based use case, but we actually needed to work out how to share data, how to share revenue, how to actually make that horizontal or ecosystem work. And I think all the time that we perhaps look at these things as technological problems rather than the use cases actually being about how you get the business model to work, particularly in terms of how you monetize it, we'll always be one step behind. And actually, I think one of the critical things to that is bringing the legal side of it right the way up front, so that you have some of those types of discussions early on rather than leaving that type of thing possibly to the end.
Yeah, and I would add a couple of other perspectives to this also, right? I think when we look at the current constructs, we are looking at, you know, longer term type relationships. We've always thought about it in the context of a product lifecycle or an experience lifecycle that spans across, you know, multiple months or multiple years. And, you know, a 10-year JV is a 3-year contract or a 1-year contract seems to be something that actually gives you the advantage of not just from a competition standpoint, but also from a price protection standpoint and a supply availability standpoint, right? But if you start flipping that around and start thinking about product life cycles or experience life cycles that are much shorter, much more individual, and much more diverse, where you're not talking about, you know, kind of going back to Martin's example, it's just a season of you know, theater, and the next season is going to be different theater, so you got to bring a different cast of characters. You just can't continue to use them. And the nature of that contract and the nature of that relationship also has to match, you know, the lifespan of that experience. So if we flip that around and start thinking along those lines, I'm pretty sure we'll come up with, you know, new ways of thinking about it. Like I'll give you an Instacart example. I mean, you basically sign up, you know, with you know, your credit card, and here's my contract as an individual, you know, consumer with you as a company. And on the back of it, there is another contract that the company has with the driver or the shopper. Right. So I get into a 3-way contract without even knowing that I'm in a 3-way contract with somebody, and I'm there for only that one delivery that was done for me. Right. And I don't even think twice about that. But that's the kind of fluidity that needs to come in terms of our business mindset, in terms of the legal, you know, aspects that Jan, you brought up front.
So that leads nicely onto a question that Andy Chappell has asked. I don't know, Andy, if you can unmute yourself to ask or not. Possibly not. If not, I'll ask it for him. So Andy was asking, in light of the last 12 months of unprecedented disruption to global trade, do ecosystems offer a more resilient option for future supply chain designs? And maybe you want to talk to that first, Pawan, just building on what you were just talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we have, you know, in our supporting, you know, our client operations across the globe for, you know, more than 500 large global brands. You know, every single one of them has seen resilience come from the concept of connectivity, the concept of collaboration, and the concept of access to information. Because all these three are, I think, the building blocks of understanding, you know, how and what you would do to react to this pandemic. Now, like a good example of this is on the ocean shipping side, the ability to send and receive shipments is a function of, you know, if you're doing it based on paper, you have to physically be there to send stuff and receive stuff. If you're able to pivot out and think about that in a digital concept and say, at a click of a button, I can not just create a shipment, I can also upload all my documents that, you know, go along with that shipment, not just to clear customs, but also to be able to go through the receiving process. all of a sudden now I don't have to be physically present to actually orchestrate that particular shipment. And I'm not talking about picking and placing the shipment. I'm really talking about the receiving process that has the right, you know, people to do that. That's an example where, you know, we've seen resiliency being built in there. The other example is the fact that you have access to a network that has more than 100 ocean shipping carriers. You don't have to go, just because your current relationship with the four carriers don't allow you to bring in enough shipments, doesn't mean that you have to go connect to another 10 on your own, right? The fact that you're on a network, all of a sudden, you can seamlessly move around from the four that you had a contract with to another four that you're going to spot buy with to move freight over. That concept starts, you know, if you extrapolate that, also starts talking to the other sources of supply, sources of distribution, dealing with, you know, constrained material or dealing with excesses that you might have on the demand side that you might want to distribute across other sources. So we've seen that very actively being deployed by our customers. And I'm also going to talk about, since there's so much data now that flows through, if you have, you know, concepts around demand sensing and artificial intelligence, we've also demonstrated the ability to forecast some of these things way ahead of time and be able to drive in more benefits just because our customers have access to more data and they have the ability to apply more AI to be able to create more accurate forecasts. And Martin talked about an example with auto. We have been able to do that across, you know, a large number of our brand owners that operate, you know, on our infrastructure.
That's great, Pawan. I just want to try and get through a number of questions. I'm going to ask the next question. And it also appears that Teams has changed its functionality. So we have to meet people, presenters, so that they can speak. We'll sort it so we're slick for next time. But for now, I'm going to ask Ahmed's question. I'm going to ask it to Martin. So with more and more processes within the supply chain becoming automated, what skill sets would you look for in graduates to support these ecosystems? And I suppose, Martin, you helped to set up some of the original MSCs around logistics and supply chain. So how do you think we're going to be changing what we're looking for in this ecosystem world?
That's a good question. I think some pretty big changes, actually. I mean, if I think back, Janet, to when we first set up that MSC in logistics and supply chain all those years ago, we're looking almost, I don't know, 35, 40 years back. It was very much what we might call sort of left brain oriented. It was very much about, you know, the sort of technology, the mechanisms. And, you know, we use a lot of formulae and we talk about optimization and all these sorts of things. And that's great stuff. It's what I think a lot of logistics has been based on. But actually, the more we move into this world of ecosystems, the more we're moving into a world which I guess could be defined as a world of complexity. So we're looking here at interactions. We're looking at how things behave in often unexpected ways. We need to be able to see the big picture. So we're really now talking about a lot more sort of right brain skills, I think. And this is much more difficult in a way to teach in the classroom. This is about systems thinking. It's about being able to understand relationships, and it's about empathy. It's about all of the things which don't really fit neatly into a sort of classic supply chain 101 course, so to speak. So I think it's a very good question from Ahmed, and the need is there. It's increasingly, I think, critical. And I'd begin, I think, by saying let's see if we can teach a little bit more around the existing body of knowledge that already exists in complex systems thinking. I think we can learn a lot from that. And also, we've been talking about ecosystems. Well, that all comes from ecology, basically. And I think there's a lot that we can actually gather if we're prepared to spend a little bit of time looking at how ecosystems in nature, for instance, operate and what makes them resilient and so forth. So, yeah, I think it's a really critical requirement, this, that we do look very hard at our curriculum and what we teach in the classroom.
No, and it's interesting when you reflect on the systems thinking and the ecology aspects, because, of course, they are absolutely fundamental to the shift to a more circular economy.
Yeah.
And perhaps some of the courses that have been around a while that actually are more about sustainability and the circular economy actually already have content like that naturally as part of them. And actually, WMG is part of one of the new UKRI interdisciplinary research centres for the circular economy. We're involved in the circular metals one. And our particular work package is with Brunel University, but it's with their design department, mm-hmm. which is a very different way about thinking about things. So perhaps it is about this slightly... it's bringing together disciplines in a more transdisciplinary way, so we don't necessarily need to recreate those materials, but we bring in other viewpoints to augment the curriculum. It's not necessarily starting from scratch. I think you just maybe think about as you use those words, Martin. So last questions to Pawan. It's quite a long one. So it's really about your four elements that you highlighted as key to orchestrating the digital supply chain. And they're quite technical in their nature. And so there was a question here about what do you think of the idea that a significant reason that many initiatives to create collaborative supply chains fail is not because of technical infrastructure, but is around insufficient skills. Particularly in terms of alignment, common objectives, managing complex relationships, etc. So I suppose it's a similar question, but more from an E2Open perspective. How, you know, you've got the technical solution, but how do you make it work in practice?
Yeah, so, you know, this is one of my favorite topics, and I'll I tend to get on a soapbox when we have this discussion internally, right? So it's people talk about data quality, people talk about lack of connectivity, people talk about skill sets. But I think the most important part that I think is really, really important ingredient is the business process. When you take the existing business process that is siloed and you try to automate it, you're not going to get anything better, right? You got to think about what is the possibility? What is the end outcome that you're trying to achieve? And if you had all the technology available to you, what would your ideal business process be? And think about that in the context of knocking down all the existing organizational walls that have been created and all the existing enterprise walls that exist in the end-to-end supply chain. And when you start thinking about that long-running end-to-end business process and approach it from that mindset, a lot of things fall into place. And a lot of times you'll realize that, you know, you were doing things because of technical reasons, or you're doing things because the technology was not there, compute power is not there, or I did not have the reach of what I needed to, or, you know, I didn't have the right skill set in my function. So if you think about the end-to-end business process and approach it from that perspective, and then overlay the concept of, okay, how do I actually turn that business process live? Where is the data sitting from? Who are the participants in that business process? Do those systems belong to me? And are they in that mishmash of a spaghetti mix of what exists today? Or are those people belonging on my badge, or they're somebody else's badge? How do I actually bring them into the business process so that they can operate as one? Like, how do I actually have that those conductors and the troop of people all coming together to perform that, right? Getting the script is the most important. Getting the play is the most important. That's what I call the process. And also recognize, most importantly, that that script and that process has to change. It's not that you create it once and you're going to run that thing for the next 20 years. As the business changes, the business process also changes. And as a result, you continue to evolve that on that front. So if you put it in that context, you know, a lot of that stuff to turn it on and keep it live and bring the right skill set in the mix. And going back to Martin's point, move away from the left brain to the right brain concept. There are enough people in the mix that have that ability to switch from left to right, but we have not given them the opportunity to do that.
Brilliant.
That's what I think about.
So I'm afraid we're just about to run out of time, but I just very quickly want to ask my colleague, Liz McArdle, who has an opportunity that she very quickly wants to share for those of you who are based in the UK.
Thanks, Jan. I'll be extra quick. So it's a programme that's based around the West Midlands. So it's looking for partners that are working in the West Midlands, though not all companies would need to be in the area. And it's essentially trying to see if it's possible to take a supply chain and use their technology or their innovation and transplant it into another industry. So in this case, the focus is taken into sustainable aviation and aerospace. So within this slide deck, you will see the information round about it, what it contains. And I think one of the things that is important to flag up about the programme is that it allows you, if you're successful in getting into it, to actually get contact with the end user. So again, focusing very much on what is the need there, as opposed to trying to push the technology into the industry. But the details will be in your pack. So please have a read at it, share it around your network, and hopefully we get some interesting results.
Thank you, Liz, and I'm sorry to have squeezed you for time. So just to wrap up, I would like to express my sincere thanks to Martin and Powan for what I think you'll agree has been a truly fascinating presentation. It's always, well, I always still find it great to hear from Martin, and it's interesting how some of the concepts like taking an end-to-end business approach, which Powan was just talking about, Martin has been talking about for a number of years, but we now have a chance to put them actually into reality. And it's equally great to see how platforms like E2Open can help us to do that. Our next event is an exciting one where we are actually launching our Supply Chain Resilience Hub. So please do join us in May for that launch. And without, just to close off, I would just like to thank Martin and Powan. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.